The following program is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. I'm Kurt Benrud. Welcome to Science Fiction Shorts, brought to you by a team of volunteer readers. Our program will be available in podcast after the initial broadcast.
My name is Renita Banerjee, and the story I'm about to read is titled Contact by Kyle Richardson. The beacon looks strange in his hand, like it's missing something, even though it's complete. It has to be complete. Every component allocated to its precise location. And what is reality but a connection of moving parts? What is life but a collection of interlocked gears? Still, the beacon looks strange. It is all assembled, he says. And yet you don't have the faintest freaking clue what you're doing, says the girl. She tilts her body over the ship's hull and peers down at him. Her black hair swings down and hangs in front of her face, so it's impossible to tell if she is smiling or not. I thought robots were supposed to be smart. Her voice ricochets inside him, bouncing off the churning parts, the twisting parts, the parts that always seem completely and inexplicably still. Robot. The word digs in somewhere it shouldn't be and refuses to budge. I am Chonks, he says. It is the name I have been given. The girl pushes away from the hull and slides to the ground, out of sight. It's a name that was printed on your chest plate, she says. Her voice rebounds off the night-darkened trees. Who knows what it means? But someone knows. He glances up at the cloud-flecked sky, at the murky stars beyond it. Someone out there. He eyes the beacon once more and says, "That is why I must secure a connection." The girl steps into view and touches the metal bulk of the ship, her finger tracing each indentation, each impact groove, each jagged smoking hole. "Your spaceship is screwed, Chonks," she says. She narrows her eyes at the dented beacon in his hand. "And so's your little walkie-talkie. You're not connecting with anyone." He tilts the beacon back and forth. He studies the fractal spines, the imperfect symmetry. Nothing about it matches the ship. The molecular structure is all wrong. The construction is rudimentary at best. Still, what else could it be? "Perhaps it requires an energy source," he mutters. The girl exhales, blowing her bangs away from her green eyes. "Maybe it does, but I'm tired. I'm hungry and I'm cold as hell. Can you do your little homework assignment later?" He can. Time, it seems, is no hindrance. His cells do not age. His body does not rust. The same must be true for those who have sent him here. Yes, for the human girl, his beacon can wait. "I would like to resume tomorrow," he says. The girl frowns, the skin around her eyes crinkling. "Whatever." "Tomorrow it is, then. Tomorrow he will provide an energy source. Tomorrow he may finally make contact." He disassembles the beacon swiftly, unlatching the pieces in a clicking blur. Then he follows the girl up the muddy hillside while the rain begins to fall. The girl watches him shut down. His red eyes dim, his joints sag. His metal skin grinds against the rocky cave wall until he's slumped diagonally against it. Hell, it almost looks like he's drooling. Why can't she sleep that well? She tosses another stick into the trembling fire and hugs her knees to her chest. In the dirt by her boots, the pieces of the beacon glint in the firelight. She pushes them around with her pinky finger, then sighs. It was never supposed to go this far. Hell, how was she to know he'd believe it? The so-called beacon, this glimmer of hope that somewhere out there someone was looking for him. God, it was supposed to be a joke. But the way he looked at it, the way his eyes lit up, the way he leaned in and touched it so gingerly, so carefully, so full of awe and wonder. How can she tell him the truth now? And what would she even say? That she was just messing with him? Damn, that'd be harsh, even for a freaking robot. God only knows where he came from. She sure as hell doesn't. But one thing she does know, nobody's looking for him. Nobody will ever be looking for Chonks. He's just some alien robot that crashed on the wrong damn planet. And now she's stuck with him. She frowns and scoops up the gleaming pieces, then lays them quietly on his limp metal hands. She kicks at the fire until it sizzles out. Then she trudges down the mountainside with her tattered pack jostling against her hip. It's about a mile to the junkyard, more or less. She winces up at the rain. She should be back within the hour. He wakes to the sound of the girl's voice, fragile, musical. "Up an atom, Chonks," she says. "Look what I found." His eyes blaze, the cave flickers. Her face spirals into view. He glances down at her outstretched hand, at the metal parts pinched between her dirty fingers, and something in him twists and spins. "What is it?" he says. The girl rolls her eyes. "What do you think it is?" She thrusts the metal pieces toward him. "It's more parts of the beacon, stupid." His chassis whirs, his joints flutter. He cups his hands below the girl's wrists. "May I have them?" "Hell," the girl grins. "I guess so." She drops the pieces onto his reflective palms. Then she points at him and says, "But I'm hungry. Find me some breakfast first." Breakfast. The word fractures in him and blooms. Nutrients. Organic matter for digestion. On a planet as thriving as this one, breakfast should be a simple task. "I will find you some breakfast first," he says. "Then I would like to resume my little homework assignment." The girl frowns, her shoulders sag, just a little. Then she smiles, the skin around her eyes staying smooth. "Whatever you want, Chonks." He looks down at the new components. One is caked with dirt, the other crumpled and tinged with rust. Yet again, the beacon surprises him. What function could these new pieces serve? But the girl hungers. Breakfast first. Then he will surely make contact.
This is Steve Lord reading From the Divide by Nathan Tavares. "You'll get to see the sky," they said. "We see the sky all the time," we said. "Hello, look out the window." "No," they said, "you don't see how it's supposed to be. What you see outside is blackness, empty. The sky back home is really blue." "But this is home," we said. "It wasn't always," they said. They told stories to us about other things. Big oceans and ships that floated on them, taking people to other shores. They had to explain shores, too. Then land, continents. "We boarded our ship with our parents when we were about your age," they said. "But we remember home so well because we miss it so much. We'll get to show it to you soon." When we were alone, our parents back in the bridge with their screens and maps, we laughed. Oceans, birds in the air, we rolled our eyes. Right! We were alone a lot. Our parents were busy exploring, they said, mapping stars, pointing things from the ship out into the blackness, while the rest of us hung out. "Look at me, I'm a cat," we'd say, crouched on all fours. We could barely talk because we were laughing so hard. "Look, we're not making this up," they said. They flicked movies of home onto one of the walls. Mountains that reached into the air, cliffs that broke into the ocean, dried riverbeds, bones of huge things in the earth. We didn't laugh much during the movies. After, we went to bed dizzy, heads full, dreaming of weird things beyond the gray walls, the tall windows, and the darkness outside of home. "When will we get there?" "It's still far away," they said. "But soon. The ship moves fast, faster than light." When we looked confused, they said, "It's complicated." This is what they say when they don't want to explain things. It's complicated. Sometimes, when we have to travel really far away, we'll sleep. Rows of small rooms. Our parents seal us inside. "Just like taking a nap," they said. "Only when you wake, we'll be far away. The stars will look different." We woke up. The stars looked the same. "Almost there," they said. "You'll be able to see everything we talked about. The sun, the sky, the water." "What does it feel like, the sun?" we asked. Our parents waited for a while. They were quiet. We expected them to say, "It's complicated." They rubbed the backs of their arms. For a while, their eyes looked gone. "We can't really describe it," they said. "You'll have to wait and feel it for yourself." When we land, we climb down a ladder into the dirt. The dirt feels too soft. The sun doesn't feel good on our skin, like they said it would. Too bright. Some of us are scared. "Where's the top of the sky?" "The sky is open," they say. "See, it's blue, like we said." We huddle close together. They bring us to the edge of the water. "This is the beach," they say. "That's sand. You can play here. It's fun." When the wind blows sand, it hits our skin and feels sharp. The water licks sand and then skitters back to the ocean. The water makes dirty foam on the rocks. "Go on," they say, pushing us. "Play." "The water is too cold. It stings. Chunks of things hit our legs." "Seaweed," they say. We want to get out of the water to go back on the ship, but we stay for them. We turn back to them. They're standing away, arms crossed. We hear one of them ask another, "Is this how you remembered it?" We dip in the waters for a while. The sun on the water reflects like bits of stars. Afterwards, we get out. They bring us towels and dry us off. When we are warm again, they tell us that we're staying, that we're finally home. All of us spend the night on the ship. Night is when the sun isn't out, which is when they say we should sleep. We feel better at night because we can see a few stars. This place is too still. Mostly we miss the hum of engines. The ship's airlocks are wide open, letting in air that smells weird. The next day they start to make a shelter. "We have to build," they say, "because everything and everyone else is long gone." We stay for a few days. It feels like a while, until they tell us that we're leaving again. We're happy. They don't look happy. All of us close the bay doors and the airlocks against the air outside. Our parents go off to the bridge with their screens, with their charts, quieter. When we're tired, we sleep. When we're awake, we explore the corners of the ship. Sometimes we make up stories about the stars we see and the planets that might be around them. Blue skies, beaches with clear, warm water. Stories are good, but we're glad we're back. We're home.
This is Kim Stamegna, and I'm reading Goes Both Ways by Sharon Fay. It took several blows before the monster stayed down. Even then, I kept swinging the axe. I didn't stop until my knees started to buckle. Only then did I put the axe down and survey my work. The red stain on the floor was a familiar scene, except instead of a young woman, a middle-aged man lay smeared on the ground. It was over. No more visions, no more being plunged into the mind of a serial killer at the moment of kill. I doubted that the PSI investigating arm of the FBI would consider this a success, but I just couldn't take it anymore. When I enrolled in the program, I was told my job was merely to gather clues, to scan the visions for anything that could uncover the killer's identity. But the closer I got to him, the further I got from myself. The visions started to seem more real than my own life. Soon I was spending more time in his sick, twisted brain than in my own. So, when I saw that he was staying one state over at the Pine Crest Inn, I didn't pass the information on to the higher-ups. I didn't want him arrested. If he got a life sentence, I'd be locked up with him, getting sucked deeper and deeper into his brain every day. I had to sever the connection myself, or I'd never be sane again. The girls had all screamed and begged. He didn't even see me coming. Once he got over his surprise, he still didn't yell. He looked like someone who had just figured out a riddle. "It goes both ways," he said, as I raised my axe for the killing blow. "It goes both ways." I brought the axe down. Once it was done, I sat on one of the motel beds. The mattress bounced under me. I felt lighter than I had in a long time. Dimly, I heard sirens. Before I had left the office, I had sent an email to my boss, telling him where I was going and why. I had put a timer on it so that it would be sent only after I had had enough time to do what needed to be done. When the police burst through the door, I stood with my hands in the air. "It's all right," I said. "I'm FBI." I reached for my badge. It wasn't there. I felt a moment of panic, but then my boss, a heavyset man with drooping eyes, stepped through the door. "Boss," I said, smiling. I let one of the cops handcuff me. "Guyvin Myers," the boss said, "you are under arrest for the murder of FBI agent Thomas Grayson." "What?" I said, jerking away from the cop. "No, boss, it's me, Tom. Guyvin Myers is the killer. What are you doing?" The boss didn't say anything, just cast a glance at the corpse and left. A cop grabbed hold of me on either side. No, this is a mistake. I'm not Myers. I killed Myers. He killed those girls, not me." I shut up as we passed the body on the floor. Next to the torso was what looked at first like an open wallet, but upon closer inspection, I saw it was an FBI ID card and badge. I saw my picture on the badge, and then for the first time, noticed how it matched the man on the floor. "It goes both ways," I thought numbly, as the cops led me to the police car. "It goes both ways."
This is Grant Young, and this story is called Dragon Bone by Mari Ness. The dreams had become no less difficult to weave, no less painful. Her hands were already raw and sore each morning, burnt in places, sometimes still oozing a bit of blood, well before she reached for a strand of dream. By the time she stopped, she could hardly bear to move her hands. Blood dripped from them into the dreams, moving between the strands. Her hands and back ached from working the vertical loom. The pain worked its way into her own sleep, waking her every few minutes. She could not remember the last time that she had slept long enough to have a chance at catching a dream herself. And yet each morning she plunged her hands into the dream threads again, biting on her tongue to keep from crying out. And now the loom was broken. The frame, carved from dragon bone, tied together by unicorn hair and gut, had snapped, leaving the entire loom and the half-finished dream on it, collapsed on the rough floor of her cave. She knelt to look. Beneath the loom and the dream threads twisted and crawled, turning in her stomach. She forced herself not to look, running her hand down the edge of the dragon bone, leaving drops of blood as she did. It must have happened in the middle of the night, she thought, during one of her brief moments of actual sleep. Or perhaps during one of her moments of unrest. She slept as far away from the loom and the crawling dream threads as she could, but she might have walked while sleeping, or not sleeping, simply forgotten it. Or possibly her blood had cracked the bone. It could happen, she knew, if a dragon bone was fed enough blood. For a moment, she rested her face in her painful hands. It could be repaired, she thought, with new dragon bone, if she had it. She did not need to search her cave to know she did not. Griffin blood could bind dragon bone, perhaps, if the binding was strong enough to hold the weaving of a dream. Perhaps. Or she could stop weaving. She thought of everything that might happen if she did. No. Or she could trade her finished dreams for a new loom, perhaps. She glanced over at the alcove where she had stacked them, not neatly. They shifted under her gaze. She knew or had known those who would pay for dreams. She could almost hear their voices now. Too much blood. Too tangled. Too painful. You should have stopped years back, back when you had what you called a skin. You couldn't keep the blood out? No wonder you shattered your loom. I like the blood. I like the blood. I like the... no. Hands still bleeding. She went back to the far corner of her cave, near the small trickle of water that was her only source for drinking and bathing, and the small box of badly tarnished silver she kept there. It hurt to open the box, and she had to pause to rinse her hands in the water, more than once, cursing as she did, cursing also that she had never taken the time to build a small pool to catch that water. But she had so many dreams to finish, and so few people came to this cave to see her, it not seemed important. She would build it after she finished repairing the loom, she told herself. Slowly, over time, but she could take the time. A few minutes each day before she went to sleep, perhaps. Doing something else might even help her sleep. Might help her remember the days when she, too, had dreams. In an alcove on the other side of the cave, the dreams she had already woven twitched a little. She ignored that. She had learned to ignore those dreams years ago. Yes. She still had a small flask of bright blue griffin's blood, and one, no, two strands of unicorn hair. It would have to be enough. She sped back to the loom. Holding the frame together so that she could attach the broken pieces would have been tricky enough with two people with uninjured hands. For her, it was impossible. In the end, she had to drop three precious drops of griffin blood on one piece of the shattered frame and quickly move the other piece towards it, pushing them together as best she could. More of her blood dropped into the dragon bone. She felt the loom shake beneath her hands. She'd have to be very careful later. And fast. She did not know how much time she had spent fixing the loom, but the light in her cave had shifted. It must have been hours. She bound the pieces again with the unicorn hair, then turned to the other side of the loom. The pieces here were in worse shape. Instead of snapping into two, they had snapped into three. And with the other side of the loom already put together, it was hard to move the pieces back into place. The loom shook again. She refused to look at her hands. She drew out the flask, slowly tilted it over the pieces, ready to slam them together, hoping that the other side wouldn't fall apart. Nothing. She tapped the flask and tilted it again. Still nothing. No. In their alcove, the woven dreams shifted again. No. She could fix this. She would. She grabbed a handful of threads meant to be woven into dreams and shoved. The threads shivered and moved against the black bone. She moved her fingers as swiftly as she could, tying, weaving, knitting a patch of dream that could hold that side of the loom together, at least for a time. So engrossed she did not feel bits of the thread entering her fingers, the palms of her hands. Though she did feel the tremors in the dragon bone, the shaking of the floor, heard something whisper in the threads. She forced her hands to move faster. She could do this. She could do this. She could. The loom crashed down around her. Two fragments of dragon bone landed in her legs, cutting her deeply. She heard herself scream. Her hands, her face, were covered in the dream stuff that had still been on the loom, unfinished. It, too, was working its way under her skin, into her blood. She crawled away, turned back, forced herself to ignore the deep cuts in her legs as she studied the shattered loom, the broken dragon bone frame. "It is over," she told herself. "Over, over." No. Yes, she could not, would not look at the all-too-small pile of dreams in that alcove. Over. Her hands shook as the dragon bone pushed deeper into her skin. When she could, when the bleeding had stopped just enough, she forced herself up, back to the tiny trickle of water in the back of the cave. She stood there for some time, letting the water pepper her skin with tiny drops. But she was still unclean when at last she moved to her bed, still covered in blood and the stuff of dreams. Perhaps that was why, for the first time, she dreamed. Dreamed of everything that might have been, of silk shattering in her hands, of fire raining down upon the sea, as dragons turned and fled. Perhaps that was why, when she woke, her eyes immediately shifted to the bright entrance to the cave, where she saw it. Dragon bone, 5 pieces, dark and shining, and below that, 3 diamond vials that would, she was certain, hold Griffin's blood. She found her diamond knife, touched the dragon bone, and began to carve a frame. This time, when her fingers bled, she did not feel the pain.
My name is Renita Banerjee, and the story I'm about to read is titled "Hey Wolf" by Abigail Ashing. The wolf is smoking a cigarette and wearing leather. He's a joke, she thinks, an after-school special. He carries groceries for old ladies. Seriously, he does. What a cliché. She shrugs off her red hoodie. He watches her pile cans of soup in paper bags. He uses the food pantry where they work. Too bad, he thinks. I'm no Prince Charming. She hands him a sack. There's a cake, 2 steak sandwiches, and a bottle of wine. The pantry doesn't distribute these. "Hey, Wolf," her note reads. "Picnic today at 3? He meets her outside the graffiti-covered community center when they stop handing out food at 3 p.m. She takes his hand, and they walk toward the park. He loves the feeling of her clawed fingers interlocking with his.
You've been listening to Science Fiction Shorts on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Kurt Benrud. My team of volunteer readers and I thank you for listening in. And we would love to have you join us next time. Just a quick reminder, this program is available in podcast, and it is intended for an audience that is blind or print impaired. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. As always, our number is 832-5138, and that's 919-832-5138. If you're a fan of sci-fi and have something to say, we want to hear from you.